Hawking's anticipation of later trends seems especially prescient when one compares his deconstructive sound collages from the 1950s and 1960s with the Art Ensemble of Chicago and other Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, AACM, efforts from the 1960s and 1970s. But by the 1970s, Sun Ra was already looking ahead again, anticipating the return to jazz roots of the 1980s and 1990s, with sweeping excursions that spanned the whole history of the music. Like Ellington, Sun Ra rarely featured his own piano work, although his few solo recordings, especially the magnificent Monorails and Satellite Session from 1966, showed that he needed no sidemen to weave his richly textured musical tapestries. And though the orchestra lacked the depth and cohesion of musicianship that characterized a Basie or Ellington, a Herman or Kenton, the band always boasted an inner circle of top-flight players. Especially in tenor saxophonist John Gilmour, Sun Ra could draw on a rugged, world-class soloist, one who anticipated and in time would influence John Coltrane. Gilmour's versatility was well-suited for the orchestra. He could contribute heated hard-bop solos, or use the tenor to articulate piercing screams, guttural barks, and mournful cries. His affiliation with Sun Ra spanned some 40 years, and he maintained his allegiance to the band even after Sun Ra's death in 1993. Count Basie's post-1951 work, The New Testament Bands, as many have called them, stands as almost the antithesis of Sun Ra and Stan Kenton's experimentalism and pluralistic tendencies. Although Basie stalked his bands of this period with outstanding young talent, versed in the bebop idiom, the ethos of this latter-day unit shared many similarities with his various Kansas City and swing-era ensembles. Basie, old or new, would swing his band to perfection, achieving the comfortable sense of forward motion that jazz musicians describe as in the pocket. Basie's unsurpassed instinct for the right tempo was never more inspired than on his hit recording of Lil Darlin'. Rather than playing this piece at the medium tempo that composer Neil Hefti envisioned, Basie slowed it down to a pace only slightly faster than a ballad, but somehow maintaining the finger-snapping momentum of a groove tune. The result was magical. Basie drew on an outstanding crop of writers, including Hefti, Ernie Wilkins, Frank Foster, Quincy Jones, Thad Jones, and Benny Carter. A wry sense of humor often pervaded these arrangements, as in the Count's post-war warhorse, April in Paris, arranged by Wild Bill Davis, with its fool-the-audience fake ending. The band's charts were more richly textured than in the pre-war years, but were never so busy as to distract listeners from the talents of Basie's star soloists. These were inevitably quite formidable, even during his bleakest days of the early 1950s, when Basie needed to downsize to a combo. He could still call on the services of Clark Terry, Wardell Gray, Buddy DeFranco, and Serge Chaloff. After resuming his big band, Basie carefully stocked his group with strong musical personalities. Eddie Lockjaw Davis was a gripping soloist, a modernist with deep roots in the jazz tradition, whose talents were often underappreciated during the age of Rollins and Coltrane. Brass player Thad Jones, brother of celebrated pianist Hank and drummer Elvin Jones, would later lead an important big band of his own, but in the 1950s and 1960s, he provided crisp solos and top-notch charts to the Basie Orchestra. Altoist and clarinetist Marshall Royal was also a member of a renowned jazz family. His brother, trumpeter Ernie Royal, had worked with Basie in 1946 and went on to play with Woody Herman, Duke Ellington, Stan Kenton, and Gil Evans. Marshall's playing was enriched by a full and bittersweet alto tone and an understated sense of swing that contrasted with his hard-nosed character. A strict disciplinarian, Royal was given authority by Basie to instill musical order into the band, a role that he filled with zeal. Vocalist Joe Williams worked with Basie from 1954 to 1961, as well as for sporadic periods in later years, and earned particular notice for his 1955 performance of Every Day I Have the Blues. Blessed with a resonant, full-bodied voice, Williams forged a style built on a fusion of opposites, a heavy dose of blues and gospel roots, varnished with an unflappable layer of supper club elegance. Other stalwart members of post-war Basie bands included Frank Foster, Frank Wess, and the indefatigable Freddie Green, a pioneer of the Old Testament band whose affiliation with Basie would come to span a half-century. A handful of other leaders pursued a similar vision of the big band in the modern age. Harry James's unfairly neglected work from his later years found him fronting a hard-swinging band in a Basie mold, which kept him viable through Las Vegas appearances and dance engagements, supplemented by occasional forays back east and overseas. Other big bands, such as those led by Les Brown or Doc Severinsen, found stability and a steady paycheck playing for television shows, where they gave viewers an occasional glimpse of the talent hidden in their ranks. But such longevity was rare in an age in which most jazz orchestras lasted weeks or months, or sometimes for a single record date, rather than years. Most of the major figures in modern jazz, Miles, Monk, Gillespie, Parker, Mingus, tried their hand at fronting larger ensembles at some point, but these were sporadic episodes in careers that flourished primarily in small combo settings. Many prominent arrangers also turned to leading big bands in an effort to have their music heard, with results that were sometimes creative but rarely financially sound. From 1952 to 1957, Eddie Sauter, who had made his name writing for Norvo, Goodman, and Shaw, teamed up with another big band alumnus, Bill Finnegan, who had similarly worked with Dorsey and Miller. Their Sauter-Finnegan band garnered recognition for its innovative use of unusual instruments and an expanded rhythm section. In later years, other big band leaders, Don Ellis, Maynard Ferguson, Buddy Rich, prospered for greater or longer periods by tapping into new musical trends, rock, fusion, electronics, odd time signatures, and various popular or novelty forms of music aimed at younger audiences. Other bands survived by staying close to home, where regular or semi-regular gigs helped pay the bills. These city bands, as opposed to the territory bands of earlier years, included Herb Pomeroy's Boston-based unit, the Orchestra in Washington, D.C., and Rob McConnell's Boss Brass in Toronto. Los Angeles boasted an especially impressive array of hometown big bands that rarely ventured outside Southern California, including ensembles led by Gerald Wilson, Terry Gibbs, Roy Porter, Bob Florence, Marty Paich, Bill Holman, Bill Berry, Claire Fisher, and the one co-led by Frank Capp and Nat Pierce. New York also saw a panoply of short-lived big bands, some playing original music, but many also serving as repertory groups focused on recreating jazz sounds from earlier decades. From the mid-1960s to the late 1970s, the Thad Jones-Mel Lewis Band stood out as the most celebrated and polished of the New York big bands. Started in late 1965 as a rehearsal group, the band secured a Monday night gig at the Village Vanguard the following February. The Sidemen were paid a meager $17 for their services, increased to $18 after they proved their drawing power, roughly the same in absolute dollars as the major big band leaders had paid their Sidemen during the Great Depression. Despite the low wages, Jones and Lewis attracted many of the finest New York players and writers to their band. The Reed section featured Joe Farrell and Eddie Daniels, and in later days, Billy Harper and Gregory Herbert, playing alongside seasoned veterans such as Pepper Adams, Jerry Dodgen, and Jerome Richardson. The brass sections could rely on leader Jones as well as, at various points in the band's history, trombonists Bob Brookmeyer and Jimmy Nepper, and trumpeters Snooky Young, John Faddis, Marvin Stamm, and Bill Berry. Drummer Lewis anchored a solid rhythm section that combined the elegant piano stylings of Thad's brother Hank Jones and, in later days, Roland Hanna, Walter Norris, Harold Danko, and Jimmy McNeely, with the bass lines of Richard Davis and, in the early 1970s, George Mraz. The impeccable musicianship of the band was supported by an outstanding library of arrangements. Leader Jones brought with him a number of charts he had written for Count Basie. His writing spanned a wide range of moods, from the tenderest lullaby waltz, A Child Is Born, to the hardest-edged New York workout, Central Park North. Bob Brookmeyer also contributed a number of major works, including a series of stunning reworkings of some of the oldest jazz standards, such as St. Louis Blues, composed in 1914, Willow Tree from 1928, and Willow Weep for Me, written in 1932. Jones left the band in early 1979 to take on a position as leader of the Danish Radio Orchestra in Copenhagen. For the next decade, Mel Lewis continued to lead a big band on Monday nights at the Vanguard, playing his last gig with the group only a few weeks before his death in February 1990. But the ensemble overcame this blow as well, surviving in the form of the Vanguard Jazz Orchestra, a cooperative effort that maintained the once-a-week tradition in Manhattan's most venerated jazz night spot. The only major challenge to the Thad Jones-Mel Lewis Orchestra's preeminence as the leading mainstream large ensemble during the 1970s came from another city band with two leaders, the Toshiko Akiyoshi Lou Tobacken Big Band, which flourished on the West Coast from 1973 to 1982. Akiyoshi was an unusual presence in the jazz world, an Asian woman born in China and reared in Japan who made a reputation in a field previously dominated by American males. A skilled pianist in a Bud Powell vein, Akiyoshi wrote almost the entire book for the band, often drawing on her Japanese heritage in the same manner that Scott Joplin and Duke Ellington extracted art music from their African-American roots. Her work was especially skilled in its subtle and versatile use of the reed section. Members doubled on several horns. Collectively, they were reportedly capable of playing 17 instruments. On The First Night, for example, Akiyoshi created harmonies voiced for 5 flutes, while on American Ballad she combined 2 flutes with 2 clarinets and bass clarinet. The most formidable member of the section was Akiyoshi's husband and co-leader, Lou Tabakan, whose contributions emphasized his classically tinged flute playing and his Rollins-inspired tenor efforts. The band also benefited from the underrated talents of Bobby Shue, a fluid soloist on trumpet and flugelhorn, who combined impeccable technique with a glorious, slightly out-of-focus tone. After moving to New York in 1982, Akiyoshi started another band with new players, although Tabakan continued to be featured as star soloist. Akiyoshi finally disbanded the larger unit in 2003, but the body of work she put together during this 30-year run stands out both for its artistry and its defiance of the economic constraints that made such longevity the exception rather than the rule for big bands in the modern era. Akiyoshi's example was not an isolated one. Maria Schneider provides an interesting case study in both the financial and creative ferment of the early 21st century jazz scene. Schneider has persisted in the face of constant challenges, honing her craft and building her audience on a half-dozen leader dates of the highest caliber. Yet despite Grammy Awards and recurring appearances at the top of polls ranking contemporary composers and arrangers, she has never enjoyed a contract with a major label, and in recent years has relied on subsidies from fans in an innovative cost-sharing arrangement pioneered by the Artist Share label. What a turnaround from the swing era, when the big band was home to the best-paid musicians in America and offered the most secure employment. Schneider, who was born in Windom, Minnesota in 1960, benefited early in her career from the mentoring of Gil Evans and Bob Brookmeyer, and her own mature work reflects the varied tonal colors and relaxed fluency with the jazz vocabulary of these past masters. She marries her deftly painted soundscapes with sweeping melodies and a hard-on-sleeve, emotional immediacy that would have made her a star of Tin Pan Alley in an earlier day. But she also makes bold moves in plotting the structure and texture of her compositions, revealing fresh possibilities in the venerable big band tradition. Perhaps the best comparison point here is not previous jazz orchestra leaders, but classical composers such as Aaron Copland and George Gershwin, who managed to be both progressive and popular in their day, pushing ahead with visionary works that didn't require a conservatory degree to appreciate their appeal. On performances such as Evanescence from the 1992 album of the same name, Three Romances from Concert in the Garden, and Cerulean Skies and The Pretty Road, from the 2007 Artist Share release Sky Blue, Schneider has established herself as a modern-day heir of Ellington and Evans, able to put her personal stamp on charts where she somehow balances the intricacies of her often through-composed music with an affable tunefulness that few of her contemporaries can match. Indeed, these pieces would stand out if played on an upright piano in your grandma's parlor, although her rich orchestral palette makes them especially suited for the big band idiom. It is one of the tragedies of jazz in the new millennium that an artist such as Schneider has been forced to scuffle to keep her big band music alive. Yet it is also testimony to her persistence and the flexibility allowed by new business models in jazz that she has risen to the top of her field despite an economic and cultural environment inhospitable to big band jazz. Schneider's influence can be detected in the work of other promising band leaders of the new millennium, such as Darcy James Argue, who adds more rock flavor to his charts, and Joseph C. Phillips Jr., who incorporates large doses of minimalism. Yet for most jazz musicians and fans in the 21st century, the big band is more a tool of historical pedagogy than a means of artistic expression. This is not an entirely new situation. Ever since Goodman's Carnegie Hall concert, the idea of using larger groups to tell the history of jazz has found favor. But today, this historical approach has become a predominant force in shaping the way musicians and the listening public view big band music. Illustrious institutions, the Smithsonian, Carnegie Hall, and especially Jazz at Lincoln Center, play an ever-expanding role in defining the role of larger ensembles in jazz music. But the single biggest source of big band music in contemporary America is the college campus, where student big bands, some even capable of matching professional ensembles in their standards of musicianship, are an entry point into the art form for a large number of teenagers and young adults. This is one area of growth in a shrinking idiom, but its impact may be felt more as a support in preserving the traditions of the music rather than charting its future course. Perhaps the jazz big band will travel the same path as the symphony orchestra, with band leaders treating the presentation of older works as their primary function. But can this situation really be surprising, given the changed circumstances in the jazz world? In recent years, for the first time in the history of the music, most of the major pioneers in the development of jazz are mere names in history books and on CD covers, and even those who have first-hand experience of having heard these masters in the flesh are now a dwindling group. In the absence of those who developed and refined the conventions of big band music, the sustainability of the rich tradition created by these innovators depends very much on institutions to promulgate and preserve their legacy. To lament this shift is as pointless as bemoaning the fact that so many jazz big bands today are resident in high schools and colleges. These are signs of jazz's success in entering the mainstream culture, not symptoms of failure. The pedagogy of jazz is not the problem, unless it dominates our attention so much that creative work of the present day is stifled. By the same token, discarding or ignoring the music's history is no solution. The jazz tradition in general, and big band jazz in particular, if they are to survive in any meaningful way as a cultural force, will require a healthy dose of this very same supercharged historical consciousness. The only danger, and a very real one, is that our respect for the past comes to blind us to the needs of the present. Coming to grips with that second task, one of defining and addressing current needs, for which jazz and the other arts can act as a kind of salve, is beyond the scope of the present historical endeavor. By definition, it comes at the point where any historical project ends. But readers should be advised, this question of present needs and the future history of jazz is never far away from our discussion, and will continue to lurk quietly behind the scenes during the concluding sections of this work. For in the jazz world, itself a microcosm of broader artistic trends, the social and aesthetic role of the music has become increasingly uncertain in the modern era, as conflicting visions of the purpose of art clash and styles grow more fragmented. In this charged atmosphere, all agendas become suspect, and even the concept of a history of the music, with the sort of stately chronological unfolding that we associate with such narratives, is not beyond debate. Chapter 7. The Fragmentation of Jazz Styles. Trad Jazz and Cool Jazz. The ascendancy of bebop inevitably invited challenges, a music so radical in its intentions, so open in its defiance of conventions, almost demanded dramatic responses. Perhaps the greatest surprise, though, was that the ripostes came from so many different directions at once. One expected the swing-era veterans to launch heated counterattacks on the boppers, and this they did with a vengeance. Less expected was the extraordinary rebirth of traditional jazz in the late 1940s, championed by those who hoped to douse the fires of bop with Lou Waters. Still others sought a tempering effect in the cool, brandished as nothing less than a new aesthetic for modern jazz. And as the 1950s progressed, a host of other alternative styles emerged on the scene, each with a contingent of devotees: hard bop, West Coast jazz, soul jazz, modal jazz, third stream jazz, free jazz. In the jazz press, interviews and reviews were now interspersed with polemics and philosophical musings on the validity of these various forms of improvised music. The most popular rebuttal, a time-honored approach since the advent of bop, was to deny that the opposition's music was real jazz. During these Cold War years, fans split into factions, and factions subdivided faster than suburban real estate. Of course, jazz had always been a source of controversy since at least the time of Buddy Bolden. Only now the disputes were mostly fratricidal, with few besides jazz fans paying attention. The general public had gone on to other concerns: Bobby Soxers and bomb shelters, television and 3D movies, pop singers backed by string orchestras, and the nascent sounds of rock and roll. In this context, jazz had become a subculture, surviving on the fringes of the entertainment industry. Meanwhile, jazz writers debated the future of jazz. Would it be hot or cool? Would it hail from east or west? Would it maintain allegiance to tonality or demand freedom from the tyranny of the chord? But for the most reactionary fans, this very obsession with the future was castigated, renounced in favor of a return to the past. Under a variety of banners, some calling it traditional or trad jazz, others referring to it as New Orleans or Chicago jazz, still others preferring the term Dixieland, the sounds of older jazz styles grew ever more popular. As early as the late 1930s, the first signs of a traditional jazz revival could be seen, but this movement would not gain momentum for another decade. By then, the growing antipathy to bop in certain quarters, certainly among the general public, but also among many jazz fans and musicians, made this return to the roots more than a casual indulgence of nostalgia. It coalesced into a movement and, irony of ironies, borrowed some of the revolutionary ideology of the boppers. Thus the trad fans were not just interested in hearing their music, but also wanted to hold it up as a model, assert its primacy, and use it to oppose the enemy in the other camps, much like the boppers had done a few years before. The jazz press fueled this antagonism with the tone of its coverage, pitting one faction against the other with the zest of boxing promoters. Booking agents followed suit, staging musical battles between boppers and traditional jazz players. A few tried to stay above the fray. Charlie Parker, in his various interviews, had only praise for the exponents of earlier styles. But most fans and players, critics and impresarios, felt compelled to choose sides. The chronology of this return to the roots begins with the resurgent careers of Jelly Roll Morton and Sidney Bechet at the close of the 1930s. Around this same time, jazz historians latched onto the forgotten trumpeter Bunk Johnson, who parlayed his New Orleans connection into a brief period of fame during the 1940s. Johnson's various claims and pronouncements on jazz history later turned out to be largely bunk, and his trumpet playing made few listeners forget Armstrong and Beiderbecke. But his transformation into a mini-celebrity indicated that the traditional jazz revival was a powerful force, one that could build a substantial following for an aging field worker who had never been more than a second-tier player during his prime. Johnson's lead was followed by many others. George Lewis, who had been making a living as a dock worker, displayed the simple elegance of his clarinet playing on a 1942 session with Johnson, an association that led to a spate of other opportunities to record and perform as a leader. Kid Ory, who had been working on a poultry farm and in a railroad office, returned to active playing in 1942 and delighted audiences for the next quarter of a century, then retired in Hawaii, far from brass bands and second lines, on the proceeds of this unanticipated career turnaround. Like tribal elders in a gerontocracy, these survivors of jazz's earliest days now found themselves venerated and apotheosized in a manner they had never enjoyed in the past. Suddenly they were historical figures. Formerly they had simply been musicians, often part-time or unemployed. Almost from the start, the veteran trad jazz players were joined by New Orleans revivalists who brought with him few connections to the Crescent City, merely a zest for the older sounds. On the West Coast, California native Lou Waters founded a traditional jazz group in 1940, the Yerba Buena Jazz Band, that would enjoy a wide following. Turk Murphy, a Waters sideman who formed his own traditional jazz band in 1947, achieved even greater popularity. His group graced the stage of Carnegie Hall, toured extensively overseas, and weathered every changing jazz fad and fancy for almost 40 years. In late 1937, Bobby Hackett began leading a band at Nick's, a Greenwich Village nightclub where modern jazz was anathema, and, though the trumpeter was a decade younger than most of the New Orleans-Chicago old-timers, he soon distinguished himself through his sure instinct for melodic improvisation and exalted tone. Eddie Condon, who worked with Hackett's band, pursued a similarly successful career as a revivalist, although with more substantial ties to the music's history than many late-to-the-party traditionalists could boast. Building a following at Nick's, where he continued to work until 1944, and later had his own nightclub. A number of other seasoned players, Pee Wee Russell, Bud Freeman, Edmund Hall, Miff Mole, Jimmy McPartland, and Max Kaminsky, to name a few, flourished amid the reviving prospects for traditional jazz styles. Much of the revival music, it is true, tended toward banality. It represented the way jazz might have sounded if it had existed in mid-Victorian times, quipped one critic. But at its best, this movement was capable of creating fresh, vibrant performances, such as Wild Bill Davison's November 1943 sessions with Russell and George Brunus for the Commodore label, or Muggsy Spanier's illustrious 1939 sides, which inspired comparisons with King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band. Even Bunk Johnson's once controversial recordings hold up well today, when one simply enjoys them for their verve and free-spirited interplay, and not as evidence submitted in support of a polemic. For those with ears to hear them, such efforts dispelled any notions that jazz needed to progress in order to sound good. The trad jazz revival quickly spread overseas, in some instances exerting even more influence on local tastes and talents than in the United States. The English scene was especially vibrant, under the impetus of players such as Humphrey Lyttelton, Chris Barber, and Ken Collier, among others. French clarinetist Claude Luther, who fell under the sway of Bechet after the latter's move to Europe, kept the flame of New Orleans jazz alive on the continent, as did a host of trad players in Stockholm, Rome, and other locales. By one estimate, around half of the jazz clubs in Europe would eventually come to specialize in traditional jazz styles. But other players on other continents, from Melbourne to Shanghai, would also join in the movement. More than any later jazz styles, the two-step syncopations of New Orleans and Chicago testified to the universal appeal of jazz music. But the most pervasive sign that early jazz was once again a major force came in 1947. In that year of bop triumphant, Louis Armstrong abandoned the big band format he had pursued for almost two decades and made a much-celebrated return to the traditional New Orleans style. Armstrong no doubt loved this music, but as a savvy artist in tune with changing audience tastes, he would hardly have taken such a step unless he had seen the commercial potential of the revival movement. The following year, Earl Hines followed Armstrong's lead. He disbanded his swing orchestra to take a job as pianist in Armstrong's combo. Jack Teagarden, another traditionalist who had made the move to big bands, also retraced his steps. Teagarden joined Armstrong in 1947, and in 1951 formed his own Dixieland combo. Some jazz modernists denigrated these erstwhile pioneers of jazz past and their fans, often alluding to the enthusiasts for bygone styles with a pejorative term, moldy fig. But for Armstrong and Teagarden, Hines and Bechet, this was clearly a misnomer. Their return to the tradition in their middle years signaled a revitalization in their music. Their rollicking sounds had gathered no moss, and one could, should, view these career moves as a proclamation of core values and a return to first principles in an age caught up with a sometimes too complacent frenzy of progress, in music as in all other spheres of post-war life. The most pressing challenge to bop, however, came not from these champions of the past. The cool movement, as it soon came to be known, presented an especially promising alternative to the bop paradigm. Spearheaded by members of the younger generation, most of them in their early 20s at the close of the 1940s, cool jazz was, like bop, an overtly modernist music with radical implications. Its exponents shared many of the aesthetic values of the boppers, an allegiance to contemporary trends in music, a predilection for experimentation, a distaste for conformity, and a view of jazz as an underground movement. And many had served as sidemen in prominent bop groups. Miles Davis, who would emerge as the leader of the new cool players, had worked with Parker. Even more, had looked up to the altoist as a guide and mentor. The modern jazz quartet, which would earn praise as a quintessential cool combo, got its start as the rhythm section of Dizzy Gillespie's big band. But even those with weaker links to bop, Jerry Mulligan, Stan Getz, Paul Desmond, Art Pepper, could not avoid its pervasive influence. They realized that bop was the defining style of their generation, and that even an attempt to sidestep the idiom would invariably be interpreted as rebellion against it. Davis had left Parker's band at the close of 1948, disturbed by Bird's increasingly erratic and self-destructive behavior. His new source of inspiration, arranger Gil Evans, was in many ways the antithesis of Parker. A dowdy, introspective country boy from Canada, Evans came to 52nd Street clubs wearing a cap and carrying a paper sack full of radishes, munching on them during the performance. Man, he was something else, Davis would write in his autobiography. I didn't know any white people like him. Evans enjoyed little name recognition at the time, even within jazz circles. His biggest claim to fame, to the extent he enjoyed any, was due to his forward-looking arranging for the Claude Thornhill Orchestra. The Thornhill Band was a jumble of contradictions. It was sweet and hot by turns, progressive and nostalgic, both to an extreme, overtly commercial yet also aspiring to transform jazz into art music. Like Paul Whiteman, Thornhill may have only obscured his place in history by straddling so many different styles. Chroniclers of the music, not knowing what to do with this range of sounds, prefer to relegate Thornhill to a footnote and dismiss him as a popularizer or some sort of Claude Debussy of jazz. True, this band was best known for its shimmering, impressionistic sound, exemplified in Thornhill's theme, Snowfall, but this was only one facet of the Thornhill Band. Evans, in particular, brought a harder, bop-oriented edge to the group, contributing solid arrangements of modern jazz pieces such as Anthropology, Donna Lee, and Yardbird Suite. In due course, these songs would become jazz standards, practice room fodder for legions of musicians. But at the time, Evans was one of the few arrangers interested in translating them into a big band format. Yet Evans was equally skillful in developing the more contemplative side of the Thornhill Band. His later work with Davis would draw on many devices, static harmonies, unusual instruments for jazz, such as French horn and tuba, rich voicings, refined during his time with Thornhill. Jerry Mulligan would also contribute arrangements to the Thornhill Band, and later credited the leader with having taught me the greatest lesson in dynamics, the art of underblowing. He described the Thornhill sound as one of controlled violence, perhaps an apt characterization of the cool movement as a whole. Another leading light of the later cool school, Lee Konitz, also participated in the 1947 Thornhill Band. Although Miles Davis's work the following year would be dubbed The Birth of the Cool, an inspired and influential title only added several years after the fact by a savvy marketing mind at Capitol Records, the Thornhill Band was its acknowledged model in many respects. By implication, the Thornhill 1946-47 band should be seen as the incubation of the cool. In Davis's words, "The Birth of the Cool album came from some of the sessions we did trying to sound like Claude Thornhill's band. We wanted that sound, but the difference was that we wanted it as small as possible." Gil Evans's cramped 52nd Street basement apartment became an unlikely salon during this period, a gathering place for the emerging cool school players as well as unreformed boppers. Miles Davis, Jerry Mulligan, Lee Konitz, John Lewis, and Max Roach were frequently in attendance. Charlie Parker was also a sporadic visitor, but his planned project with Evans never took place, although the two would briefly work together several years later on a subpar recording featuring the altoist in tandem with the Dave Lambert singers. At the time, Davis took the lead in forming a working band from this coterie of like-minded musicians. Davis, above all, was the visionary and organizer who turned these fledgling concepts into performances and recordings. He scheduled rehearsals, hired halls, and initiated contact with Capitol Records. However, a substantial portion of the band's arrangements were written by Mulligan, whose important role in the proceedings has often been wrongly downplayed in historical accounts, which invariably focus on Davis and Evans, with the efforts of this triumvirate supplemented by occasional charts submitted by other participants. There was no tenor sax in the Birth of the Cool Band, almost a heresy in a jazz orchestra. Instead, the French horn frequently blended with the other saxes and Davis's trumpet. The tuba, a throwback to New Orleans days, was used to support the bottom of the harmonies. This freed Mulligan's baritone to move up in register. Sometimes he would double lines with Davis or Konitz. But the conception of the ensemble was as radical as the instrumentation. For a quarter of a century, jazz big bands had been built on the opposition of sections, reeds, brass, rhythm. These served as separate, quasi-equal forces employed in musical jousting. The interplay between these sections, refined under the guidance of Redman, Carter, Ellington, and others, had come almost to define the sound of larger jazz ensembles. The model for these pioneers of big band jazz was, in some ways, the symphony orchestra, with its similar give and take between instrumental groupings. Davis, in contrast, conceived of his band as a single section. The model was not a classical orchestra, but ensemble singing. I wanted the instruments to sound like human voices, and they did. it had to be the voicing of a quartet with soprano, alto, baritone, and bass voices. I looked at the group like it was a choir. Something of the purified aesthetic of choral music also seeped into the music. Evans's arrangement of Moon Dreams captures a sweet languor unknown to the muses of swing or bop. Davis's medium-tempo Bopplicity sounds as if the band is hesitant to swing too hard, preferring instead to linger a while in the beauty of each passing chord. Even the more insistent charts, such as Mulligan's Jeru, Davis's Deception, or John Carisi's Israel, come across as similarly chastened. Was this jazz? Winthrop Sargent, classical music critic for The New Yorker, expressed his doubts. Instead, he staked a claim for the Davis Nonet as an outgrowth of the Western classical tradition. It sounded to his ears like the work of an impressionist composer with a great sense of oral poetry and a very fastidious feeling for tone color. The compositions have beginnings, middles, and endings. The music sounds more like that of a new Maurice Ravel than it does like jazz. I, who do not listen to jazz recordings day in and day out, find this music charming and exciting. If Miles Davis were an established classical composer, his work would rank high among that of his contemporary colleagues. But it is not really jazz. Jazz fans apparently agreed with Sargent's characterization. They virtually ignored the band. In time, the Davis Nonet would be lauded as one of the most innovative groups in the history of jazz. But during its brief tenure, the ensemble drew little attention or praise. Its employment was limited to a few performances at the Royal Roost, and even there the group was billed below the Count Basie Band, with whom it shared the stage. After making a few recordings for Capitol Records, the Nonet disbanded. The Cool School may well have benefited from this early failure. The members of the Nonet would have more success as individuals in promoting the cool aesthetic than as part of a single unit. Davis would continue to refine his sound in a variety of settings, and by the mid-1950s had developed a deeply personal conception of jazz, one that would exert enormous influence on later jazz musicians. Pianist John Lewis would build a major concert hall career as music director of the Modern Jazz Quartet, a cool band remarkable for its longevity and popularity, as well as its consistently high musical standards. Lee Konitz's later work would secure his reputation as one of the most accomplished altoists of his day and a leading exponent of the cool. Jerry Mulligan would take the lead in developing an audience for cool jazz on the West Coast. Gunther Schuller, who had played French horn with the Nonet, would become a key figure in promoting the Third Stream, an ambitious and controversial offshoot of cool jazz that aimed to break down barriers between classical and jazz idioms. Even hardened bopper Max Roach, the drummer on most of the Davis tracks, would bring a measured dose of the cool sensibility to his path-breaking mid-1950s band with Clifford Brown. All in all, the Davis Nonet was much like a band of disciples, gathered together for a brief time before scattering in their several separate directions, each inspired to proselytize others in turn. The roots of Lewis's Modern Jazz Quartet actually predated the Davis Nonet. As early as 1946, a predecessor group, including Lewis, vibraphonist Milt Jackson, drummer Kenny Clark, and bassist Ray Brown, performed together as the rhythm section in Dizzy Gillespie's big band. This same unit later recorded as the Milt Jackson Quartet in the early 1950s. By 1952, when the band had regrouped as the Modern Jazz Quartet, Percy Heath had taken over for Brown on bass. After the replacement of Kenny Clark with Connie Kay in 1955, the quartet would maintain the same personnel for almost four decades, an unprecedented achievement in the jazz world, where a band's longevity is typically measured in weeks or months. This career-long partnership impacted the music. Few ensembles of any era or style could play together so fluidly, so effortlessly, so well as the MJQ. Moreover, no group went further in establishing a valid chamber music style for jazz. This was more than a matter of tuxedos and concert halls. The Modern Jazz Quartet's music captured an intimacy and delicacy, a sensitivity to dynamics, that was closer in spirit to a top-caliber string quartet than to anything in the world of bop or swing. But unlike their classical world counterparts, the MJQ thrived on the tension, whether conscious or subliminal, between their two lead players. The young Nietzsche made his reputation by untangling the Dionysian and Apollonian tendencies in art. Analysts of the MJQ need to do the same. The Bacchic tendency in this case is epitomized by Jackson, a freewheeling improviser, at his best when caught up in the heat of the moment. Lewis, the Apollonian, in contrast, served as Jackson's collaborator, adversary, and spur all rolled into one. He constructed elaborate musical structures for Jackson to navigate, embellish, and at times, subvert. Such tensions between opposites often underpin the greatest art, but rarely make for stable partnerships. And in fact, Jackson's desire to perform in less structured musical environments led to the Modern Jazz Quartet's breakup in 1974. But a few years later, the group came back together for the first of many reunion concerts, tours, and recordings. Milt Jackson's singular efforts also served to bring the vibraphone into the modern age. He pared down the previously dominant style of Lionel Hampton, refining a more distilled approach, swinging, but in a softer, more relaxed manner. Commentators have sometimes suggested that Jackson's success came from emulating the saxophone on the Vibes. There is some truth to this generalization. Jackson's phrases breathed, unlike the note-filled cadenzas and ornamentation of Hampton's solo outings. His melodic lines had a lighter, airier quality, without the brittle tinniness heard in the work of many previous Vibes and xylophone players. Jackson's formative experiences had also included stints with Gillespie, Parker, and Monk, where he had been tested and found worthy in the heat of many bop battles and had mastered the intricacies of modern jazz. This background carried over to his work with the MJQ, where Jackson managed to retain a feel for the intensity of bop, even in the midst of Lewis's most attenuated compositions. Lewis, in contrast, brought a distinctly academic flavor to his jazz work. He had studied music and anthropology at the University of New Mexico and had continued his education at the Manhattan School of Music, where he eventually earned a master's degree. He, too, had worked in major modern jazz bands, including Parker's and Gillespie's, and the influence of Bud Powell could be heard, albeit muted, in his playing. For all this, Lewis was a reluctant bebopper. He lacked Powell's fire, instead favoring a more flowing, at times delicate style, one that remained somewhat at odds with a bop idiom. Yet Lewis's meticulous craftsmanship and formalist tendencies made him an ideal participant in the Davis Birth of the Cool project. Still, none of these early associations prepared listeners for the burst of creativity Lewis revealed as musical director of the Modern Jazz Quartet. Although his tastes have often been described as conservative, fueled no doubt by his interest in traditional forms, Lewis showed a voracious appetite for new sounds and experimentation that few jazz artists of his day, or any other, could match. Along with Schuller, he played a key role in furthering third-stream collaborations between jazz and classical musicians. In addition to his responsibilities with the MJQ, Lewis formed Orchestra USA in the early 1960s, an unfairly forgotten ensemble that straddled a number of musical styles and idioms. Years later, he would renew these ambitions, working with Gary Giddens and Roberta Swan to found the American Jazz Orchestra. Lewis was also an early advocate of the jazz avant-garde and was among the first supporters of Ornette Coleman, whom he encouraged to attend the Lenox School of Jazz in 1959, at a time when most jazz players were ridiculing or ignoring Coleman's work. Lewis could find jazz material in traditions few would have thought hospitable to it, everything from fugues to commedia dell'arte. But he was equally successful at penning more recognizable jazz-oriented pieces, such as his wistful ballad Django, or his riff-driven The Golden Striker. For want of a better title, he has been claimed as part of the cool jazz movement. Certainly he played a role in the growing popularity of cool jazz during the 1950s, but Lewis's activities were far too varied to be subsumed under any one heading. Although he never participated in the Davis Nonet, Stan Getz figured as one of the most prominent cool players of the period. On the heels of his ethereal 1948 performances on Early Autumn with the Woody Herman Band, a late swing-era vintage that, in retrospect, can be seen as a harbinger of the coming cool school, Getz set out on his own. At first he settled in New York, where he worked briefly as a staff musician for NBC. The confines of a regular job proved, however, too restrictive for a restless improviser such as Getz. When his recording of Moonlight in Vermont, made with guitarist Johnny Smith, whom he had met at NBC, showed signs of broadening the popular following he had gained while with Herman, Getz opted to become a full-time combo leader. During the course of the decade, Getz fronted a number of polished ensembles, including a quartet with pianist Horace Silver, a quintet with guitarist Jimmy Rainey, and a West Coast band with valve trombonist Bob Brookmeyer. Getz's lyrical style and strong improvisational skills also made him a frequent choice for all-star recording dates. Noteworthy sessions from this period include a live recording with trombonist J.J. Johnson, a collaboration with Jerry Mulligan, and a heated encounter with Dizzy Gillespie and Sonny Stitt, with the last session eliciting some of the most assertive tenor work of Getz's career. Despite the quality and quantity of his 1950s work, Getz became an increasingly isolated figure on the jazz scene as the decade progressed. Many factors contributed to his fall from grace, a much-publicized arrest for attempting a drugstore robbery to support his substance abuse habit, his decision to relocate overseas, his often changeable personality. But at bottom, it came mostly from factors beyond Getz's control. Jazz tenor sax playing in those years was moving further and further away from Getz's cool stylings. Harder-edged players such as Sonny Rollins and John Coltrane were establishing a new model for how the tenor should sound. Getz, who was always a reluctant modernist, his embrace of bop mannerisms had never obscured the more traditional roots in his playing, seemed in danger of sounding old-fashioned before his 35th birthday. But in the early 1960s, Getz mounted a major comeback that encompassed both critical success and immense popular acclaim. His 1961 recording Focus featured Getz's sleek improvisations darting in and out of Eddie Sauter's acerbic string writing. But the strong reception of this work in the jazz community paled in comparison to the huge public response to Getz's ensuing bossa nova projects. Getz may not have been the first to recognize the jazz potential of this music. Antonio Carlos Jobim's compositions and João Gilberto's vocals had attracted many admirers since their initial Rio de Janeiro recordings from the late 1950s, but no one did more to bring it to the attention of audiences outside Brazil. Getz's 1962 recording of Desafinado eventually reached number 15 on the Billboard single charts, and his Jazz Samba LP remained on the album charts for over a year, briefly capturing the top position. Quick to capitalize on this success, Getz released several other bossa nova recordings, as did a host of other jazz musicians, anxious to benefit from the Brazilian fad before it faded. In the summer of 1964, just when it seemed as if the public's appetite for the new sound had been sated, Getz achieved an even more celebrated hit single with The Girl from Ipanema. The Getz Gilberto LP climbed to number 2 on the charts, kept from the top spot only by the Beatles. But Getz's tenor work, for all its beauty, was only part of the reason for the public's warm response to the bossa nova. Jobim's compositions, with their mixture of impressionist harmonies, distinctive melodies, and bittersweet lyrics, rank among the finest popular songs of the era. In time, The Girl from Ipanema became an overplayed cocktail lounge anthem, but Jobim's entire body of work is distinguished by dozens of outstanding pieces, and his name is not out of place alongside those of Gershwin, Berlin, Rogers, and Porter in the pantheon of those who made art song out of pop tunes. João Gilberto was the perfect performer of this music. His gently stuttering guitar beat epitomized the bossa rhythm, and his whispering vocals pushed the cool aesthetic to its extreme. No singer in any idiom has ever sung with a more relaxed delivery, especially remarkable given his phrasing, seemingly so antithetical to jazz, on top of or ahead of the beat. Even Chet Baker's cooing vocals, reportedly a model for Gilberto, sound sassy by comparison. But, in a surprising twist, João's wife, Astrud Gilberto, provided the most famous vocal on the Getz Gilberto album, launching her own career with her work on The Girl from Ipanema. Astrud went on to perform with Getz's working band and made her own name as a lead act, a striking turnaround for a woman who had not been a professional singer before her Ipanema success. João, in contrast, became increasingly reclusive with the passing years, rarely granting interviews or appearing in public. After the mid-1960s, he made only a handful of records. But his beguiling 1991 release, João, and João Voz e Violão from 2000, showed that his style had changed little with the intervening years. Despite the fluctuating fashions in pop, jazz, and Brazilian music, Getz, for his part, would never again sell so many records, but he rarely looked back to the bossa in later years, preferring to return to mainstream jazz with a series of top-notch bands. His quartet with Chick Corea helped pave the way for Corea's own chart-climbing career and produced a major musical statement with the Sweet Rain recording. Later bands with Joanne Brachin, Albert Daly, Andy Laverne, Jim McNeely, and Kenny Barron continued in this tradition and maintained a consistently high level of quality, as did Getz's guest recording projects with Jimmy Rolls, Bill Evans, Diane Schur, and others. In his final years before his death from liver cancer in 1991, Goetz was able to free himself from his long-standing addiction to drugs and alcohol and find a new career mentoring young musicians as artist-in-residence at Stanford University. For a time in the early 1950s, Goetz and many other leaders of the Cool Movement resided on the West Coast. Here, cool jazz was in the ascendancy, and its leading advocates enjoyed frequent opportunities to perform and record. This marked a stark change from the late 1940s, when a small but talented group of mostly black bebop players, schooled in the clubs and after-hours spots of Central Avenue, had dominated the modern jazz scene in Los Angeles. In many instances, these players maintained their allegiance to bop in later years, but with less financial success than their cool school compatriots, or when compared with the Californians, such as Charles Mingus or Eric Dolphy, who made the smart move to New York. Los Angeles-based saxophonists Dexter Gordon, Teddy Edwards, and Wardell Gray rank among the finest soloists of their generation, and all three played a seldom-acknowledged role in defining a distinctive bop sound for the tenor sax, liberated from the Hawkins mannerisms displayed on most early modern jazz tenor outings. Of these three, only Gordon would go on to enjoy widespread fame, albeit after 20 years in relative obscurity. His early recordings for Savoy from the mid-1940s and infrequent releases during the 1950s demonstrate Gordon's freewheeling energy and his bellowing foghorn tone, one of the most distinctive signature sounds in modern jazz, while later sessions for Blue Note present the mature statements of a major soloist. Few were listening, however, and Gordon moved overseas, where he spent most of the 1960s and 1970s. Only upon his return to the United States in 1976 did the tenorist, now in his mid-50s, begin receiving the accolades and rewards his contributions warranted. Altoist Frank Morgan had an even longer wait before seeing his career blossom. His recordings from the early 1950s reveal a precocious player with formidable technique, but drug problems would sideline him until the late 1970s, and not until the mid-1980s would he enjoy the chance to record extensively and demonstrate the full scope of his abilities. Altoist Sonny Criss and pianist Hampton Hawes had played with Parker during his West Coast sojourn and developed into outstanding bop players in their own right. But both remained mostly local heroes, seldom gigging outside of California and gaining only grudging respect from the mostly East Coast-based critical establishment. Many other gifted players, Harold Land, Curtis Counts, Dupree Bolton, Frank Butler, Carl Perkins, Pony Poindexter, Roy Porter, met similar fates. Often personal problems, mostly drug-related, contributed to the hardships faced by these promising talents. But all of them also suffered from being African-American and committed to a harder-edged bop sound at a time when cool jazz, played with white musicians, was the dominant jazz style on the West Coast. A number of signal events marked the shift from hot to cool on the coast. Jerry Mulligan's relocation to California after the completion of the Davis-Nonet sessions created a direct link to the fertile East Coast cool movement. In addition, a host of former Stan Kenton sidemen, now settled in Southern California, fueled the progressive tendencies of this music, each with greater or lesser ties to the cool aesthetic. The Lighthouse, a Hermosa Beach jazz club, which had formerly featured some of the more bop-oriented black players, became a regular performance venue for many of these ex-Cantonians. The Lighthouse evolved into a public workshop for emerging jazz trends on the coast, with a panoply of players, Shorty Rogers, Jimmy Giuffre, Bob Cooper, Bud Shank, Shelly Mann, and many others, pursuing a diverse range of styles from laid-back to leading-edge. The worst of this music settled for an easy banality, an oral dose of laudanum, but more often, the Lighthouse crew tapped into the freewheeling creative currents of the time. Perhaps even more important than clubs like the Lighthouse were the independent record companies on the West Coast, notably Les Koenig's Contemporary label, Richard Bach's Pacific label, and the Weiss Brothers' Fantasy outfit. They recorded and promoted the new music, and in response to their efforts, West Coast jazz gained an international following and emerged as a viable alternative to the hegemony of East Coast models of improvisation and composition. Larger entertainment companies would gradually come to dominate the California music business during this period, with everyone from Walt Disney to MGM seeing recordings as a profitable diversification move. Capitol Records in Hollywood would enter the big leagues with its quasi-monopoly on sophisticated pop, as sung by Frank Sinatra, Peggy Lee, Nat King Cole, Judy Garland, Dean Martin, Nancy Wilson, the Kingston Trio, and other name acts. but the jazz renaissance of the 1950s was promoted primarily by smaller outfits, entrepreneurial businesses built on the growing national reputations of the local jazz players. There is little glamour in the story of these companies. Max and Saul Weiss, for example, started off running a record pressing plant and only got into the music business to maintain the throughput of vinyl and shellac. But without the intervention of such entrepreneurs, West Coast jazz might never have experienced this halcyon era. Although the movement was never as monolithic as the term suggested, a certain convergence of aesthetic values could be seen in many of the West Coast recordings. The music was often highly structured, rebelling against the simple head charts of East Coast modern jazz and reflecting a formalism that contrasted sharply with the spontaneity of bebop. Counterpoint and other devices of formal composition figured prominently in the music. Larger ensembles, octets, nonets, tentets, continued to thrive in West Coast jazz circles, long after big horn sections had become an endangered species elsewhere. Unusual instruments were also embraced with enthusiasm, and many of them, such as flute and flugelhorn, eventually came to be widely used in the jazz world. Relaxed tempos and unhurried improvisations were trademarks of the scene, and the music often luxuriated in a warm romanticism and melodic sweetness that was far afield from the bop paradigm. Although the West Coast sound has often been criticized as overly stylized and conventional, the work of many leaders of the movement, Jerry Mulligan, Jimmy Giuffre, Shelly Mann, Shorty Rogers, Dave Brubeck, reveals the exact opposite, a playful curiosity and a desire to experiment and broaden the scope of jazz music were the calling cards of their efforts. It was perhaps this very openness to new sounds that allowed many later leaders of the jazz avant-garde, Eric Dolphy, Ornette Coleman, Don Cherry, Paul Blay, to hone their styles while resident on the coast. Jerry Mulligan's stint in California lasted only a few years, but it marked a turning point in the baritone saxophonist's career. He came to Los Angeles as a relatively unheralded player and left as a major jazz star. Building on his work as composer-arranger with the Davis Nonet, Mulligan wrote charts for the Kenton Band and later undertook seminal recordings with his own large ensemble. But Mulligan's most celebrated efforts from this period were in the context of a pared-down quartet. Not only did Mulligan prove that he could write effectively without a full unit of horn players, but he even discarded the piano in this minimalist combo. In a series of memorable performances, Bernie's Tune, Lying for Lions, Lullaby of the Leaves, My Funny Valentine, and others, Mulligan exploited the potential of this limited instrumentation to the fullest through a variety of techniques: counterpoint between the two horns, use of the bass and drums as melodic voices, sotto voce bass lines with a sax or trumpet, and stark variations in pulse and phrasing, ranging from Dixieland two-steps to swinging fours to pointillistic bop beats. The media soon picked up on the novelty of the pianoless quartet, with a write-up in Time magazine exerting particular impact. Before long, patrons were lining up around the block to see the band in performance. The marriage of the cerebral and the romantic was one of the odd, enduring qualities of West Coast jazz. In the case of the Mulligan Quartet, the latter ingredient was provided mostly by trumpeter Chet Baker. There were many limitations to Baker the musician. His range was narrow, his reading skills poor, his technique so-so, his interest in composition almost nil. But as a soloist, he deservedly ranks among the finest of his generation. His instinct for melodic development was uncanny, and his improvised lines captured a touching poignancy. Movie star looks only added to Baker's drawing power, and in time, he could challenge Mulligan as a leading jazz star. Unlike the baritonist, Baker had little interest in the more experimental currents of West Coast jazz. Most of his career was spent playing and replaying the standards, recording trademark songs, in particular My Funny Valentine, so often that the estate of Richard Rogers should put up a statue in the trumpeter's honor. This conservatism would have served as the death knell for a lesser talent, but Baker proved capable of making even the most threadbare tunes sound fresh and new. In time, he branched out as a jazz singer, and though his work in this vein was more stylized than his trumpet playing, it too embodied a heartfelt incisiveness that belied its matter-of-fact conversational delivery. After the breakup of the Mulligan Quartet, Baker established himself as a bandleader in his own right. His life and times were always turbulent. Drug problems and their legal consequences were constant traveling companions, but his music was a center of stability in the widening gyre. Baker's boyish looks eventually came to be replaced by a grim reaper's visage, haggard and wrinkled, old well before its time. But the trumpeter persisted through it all. Even the loss of his teeth in a drug-related beating could only halt his career temporarily, and his last years found him recording prolifically and still capable of moments of greatness. Baker's Tokyo concert, captured on film less than 12 months before his death, on May 13, 1988, from a mysterious fall from an Amsterdam hotel window, revealed that this musician had lost none of his melodic inventiveness. And, strange to say, the music in those final days captured a